Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hey everyone, I'm Elise Gallus, and this episode is part two of Dr. Kurt Thompson's December 2022 talk on the soul of the pastor. This episode isn't necessarily meant to stand alone, so if you haven't already, I highly recommend going back and listening to part one. Enjoy!
The measure of a gathering, of its value, has everything to do with all the conversations that are taking place anytime the speaker is not speaking. Right. It's just really lovely that you're here, like clearly connected to each other, which is a really beautiful thing. So how are we doing? Okay. Not too overwhelmed yet? Not too much. Okay. So I'm going to have to work harder. Okay. Here's the thing. We could spend a week talking about what we just talked about. And we could spend a week talking about what we're going to talk about in the next 45 minutes, 50 minutes. But we don't have that time. So I want us to, I want us to be aware that one of evil's maneuvers is the maneuver of scale and pace. I now live in a world in which I'm being trained to be distracted. I'm being actively trained to be distracted. My device helps me be distracted. I'm being trained. Like, I am training my mind to be less able to be attentive than I was 5 years ago. It's important to know this. And if we're not doing regular Sabbath restraint from our devices, we're only doing the opposite. We will be more distractible a week from now, a year from now. It's just the way it's going to be. So that's a part of the pace, right? The pace is moving. I have to move from thing to thing to thing to thing. It's also part of the pace has to do with the sense of urgency. The more urgently I feel something because of my trauma, the more painful, the more overwhelming it is, the more I feel like I need to have whatever it is resolved quickly. I mean, think about this, right? If you're trying to hold your breath underwater, like as soon as like, and you've been there for like, 30 to 60 seconds, you want to get out and breathe quickly. That's not the same thing as just holding your breath for 5 seconds. You can hold your breath for 5 seconds and you don't feel the urgency to need to breathe really quickly. But if you've been holding your breath for 30 to 45 seconds, the urgency is unmistakable. So we have this urgency, this pace, and we are being trained to expect things to be resolved quickly. I now have Amazon packages that arrive at my door before I order them. It's happening. That's how fast it's happening. And I expect God to move at the pace that I am being trained to anticipate that all things should move. But the reality is, healing does not move at this pace. I mean, think about it. Lazarus, like that dude, he gets to die twice. Like, look, I'm dead. Just leave me alone. We long for our healing to come quickly. And once it's done, it should be done. And that's just not the way the world works. And so I'm saying that to us in order to, you might think like, oh gosh, thanks for the encouragement, Kurt. This just continues to get better. I want to give you a word of encouragement and hope, because when the healing does not come quickly, you need to know it's not because you're not working hard enough. It's not because you're not good enough. It's not because you're not smart enough. It's not because you haven't been to your therapist enough times. It is because this is the way beauty emerges. The things in the world that are the most durably beautiful take the longest time to create. Snowflakes are gorgeous. They are over as soon as it's 32 degrees. The Grand Canyon, that's a different story. Marriages, that's a different story. Churches, the formation of a soul, of a community of souls, that's a different story. And so I want you to know that the fact that this is going to take until we are dead is the way that it is meant to be, and Jesus is not worried about this. He's too busy doing the work that he has to do while there is light to do it. And he will say along the way, like, there's a reason why I said the gate is narrow and the lane is narrow. It's not because God is just too stingy. It's because God wants people who are really serious about living in the world where heaven is coming. And this is a challenge for us. Because like many of my patients, they come and they want to be not sick. They do not want to be well. We're going to walk through two passages of scripture in the next 40 minutes. And I want to invite you to consider that these are passages that are intended to be ingested, digested, and metabolized. We ingest things in a period of minutes. We digest things over a period of hours. We metabolize things over the course of our life. We are people who long to incorporate and appropriate things for our betterment as quickly as we can, because this is the world that we are living in that is trained to think like this is how it's supposed to happen. That's just one piece. That's just the pace. The other thing is the issue of scale. We live in a world in which anything that we do, we are trained to imagine that beauty and goodness is to be equated with scale. And that, my friends, is about empire. That, my friends, is about the Tower of Babel. That is about Babylon. That is about Nineveh. That is about Rome. That is about Washington, D.C. It is about empire. And here's the thing. I am not immune to it. I want to be famous. Like, that's silly. Like, because as Julia Roberts famously said in Notting Hill, you know, fame, it's not really real after all. I mean, no authority less than Julia Roberts said this. But like, you know, like, I want a fiefdom. I want, like, I want, like, I, the, I, did I say I'm a professional sinner? I like, I'm like, and I'm not kidding. Like, there is this part of me that wants to build things. Look, three generations from now, no one will have an idea of who I was. They won't. My own family will have no, I don't think of my grandfather Franklin Thompson unless I'm telling this part of my talk. I have no idea who he was. My great-grandfather, I have no idea who he was. Never met him. Don't think about it. And the same will be true of me. And here's the thing. Jesus is not expecting me to be building an empire for what's going to happen five generations from now for my sake. He's wanting me to pay attention to what I am doing right here and now in the light that I have. And the light that you have, I want to tell you, the light that you have, Jesus wants to use you in this time, the only time you will ever have. It is now. It is not yesterday. It is not tomorrow. 10 minutes from now. Some of us, we might not be alive 10 minutes from now. Okay, that's kind of morbid, but like, it's possible. We spend far more time in our minds paying attention to our past in regret, which is where shame operates, and in our future, where shame operates, and very little time where we actually live. And with all of that energy that I'm burning, healing is impossible to realize. Healing can only happen in the body that I actually live in the time and space that I actually occupy. And so when we talk about these passages from Hebrews and the Psalms, it's important to know, we want to apply them in the time and space that we have, recognizing that their application is to be done in the time and space that I have, and it may involve simply the people that I know. It's not like when you say, like, no, I'm a pastor of a congregation of 2,000 people. Like, no, you're not. You think, like, I thought that's what I was doing. Here's what I mean. You are not pastoring 2,000 people. You, whoever you are, you have significant relationships on a day-to-day basis with about 8 people. That's what you have. That's what your brain is actually paying attention to. When you talk about your congregation, you're talking about an abstraction that you do not in your body actually interact with. Do you know that? You're thinking, like, dang, you mean my church is only like really 8 people? Like, no. I don't mean that your church is only 8 people. What I mean is you are responsible for the lives with whom you actually interact. You're not responsible for the other 1,992 people that you don't actually know. They are responsible to somebody else. Now, are you the leader of this group of 2,000 people? Yes. Look, you get what I'm talking about. Are you with me? Because what I want you to know, I want you to hear that this is a word of relief for you. I want you to hear that God is not expecting. Look, Jesus himself did not walk around with 2,000 people. He walked around with a handful of dudes and women because, like, that's all his brain could occupy. Because, like, he's a real human being. I don't know if you know that or not, but he's like a real human. Like, it's live action. It's not pretend. He's not being something that we then think we have to be by being a pastor to 2,000 people. This is not to minimize the impact of the body. It is to maximize your awareness of all that you're expected to do. And it's not for 2,000 people. Are you with me? It's not for 150 people. Huh, I've never said all that publicly before. I don't know if this is supposed to get out or not, but who knows? If it does, so be it. Hebrews chapter 12. The first 2 verses. Therefore, since we have before us such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off all the sin that entangles us. And let us run with perseverance the race set before us, with our eyes fixed on Jesus, the author and consummator, finisher, perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and who sits at the right hand of God. Therefore, since we have before us such a great cloud of witnesses, now here's where things get difficult. At the very beginning of our time, I said nobody has a harder job than pastors. And the question is, who are your great cloud of witnesses? Now, the writer is speaking to and about those people that they've just written about, many of whom are not even alive any longer. But I want to assure us that every single one of us in this room is walking around with a cloud of witnesses in our head. Some of those witnesses are telling us that we're not enough. Some of those witnesses are telling us that we're still looking for the other 8% on our math test. Some of those witnesses have to do with the traumas of our own lives that are yet, as of yet, unresolved. Who are the witnesses in your life right now, dead or alive, that are helping you tell your story more truly? That are helping you hear the story that Jesus heard at his baptism? My gosh, You are my daughter. I've never seen anything more beautiful in my life. I can't believe I get to be your God. Imagine if you were to go home from this gathering when you leave. You walk into your kitchen and there they are. Your two best friends in the world, and they're in your kitchen. Now, for some of you, they might actually be in this room already, which means they'd have to get there pretty quickly. But if you walk in and there they are, you would first wonder, like, who died? What's wrong? Because my two best friends don't just show up in my kitchen. Unless you get there and they say, like, oh my gosh, we were just talking about you earlier this week, and we thought, we just want to be with you. And so we found a key to your house because we wanted to be here when you came home. We are so glad you're here. What would that be like? This is what the Holy Trinity is doing for us every day, all day. When you woke up this morning, there they were. They're like, oh my gosh, we've been waiting for you all night. Because you're going to go hear this shrink today. It's going to be awesome. You're going to have a great, like, but we get to share it with you. Like, we want to be with, like, we are just thrilled to be with you because we can't believe that we get to be your God. That you are my son, that you are my daughter. I will tell you, this is what it means to be seen, soothed, safe, secure. And my brain will forget it if I don't have a remembrance process whereby which this is taking place on a regular basis. Who is your great cloud of witnesses? One of the questions that I ask people often is, could you give me the names of three people such that if I asked them, they could collectively tell me everything there is to know about you? Everything. They know not just your favorite food. They would know where you were born. They would also know what your worst nightmare is. They would know what your greatest fear is. They would know what your greatest longing is. They would know the last time you gossiped about your pastor. They would, if you're the pastor's wife, they would really want to know that. They would know the last time, they would want to know all the things. There would be, they would know the last time you looked at pornography. They would know all the things. If we do not have someone who is bearing witness to our life, we are going to bury the part of our life that is still traumatized. That will be energy we will burn that will not be available to us to create the works of God that have been prepared for us before the foundation of the world. Who are your cloud of witnesses? This is important. Things don't change from the time that you come into the world looking for someone looking for you. No one needs more than a pastor does, someone looking for them. Since we have such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily entangles us. This is the big thing, right? We're all addicts. This is Gerald. Someone who asked about Gerald May? Where are you? Right? You asked about Gerald May, right? Gerald May, addiction and grace, right? He's like, look, we're all addicts. The Bible calls it idolatry. What are those things to which I give my allegiance as a way to help me cope with the parts of me that I can't tolerate? If you haven't recently, it would be a good thing for you to list your addictions. Put on a piece of paper and then share them with your cloud of witnesses. And then they're going to add to the list. You're like, dang, can't we just start with them? I don't want to Because these are the things, remember about being safe, we have to have restraint on things. This is what it means. It's back to that whole notion of the things that happen even when we're newborns. Like, we have to show restraint. We have to be able to say no to the things that are taking me away from relationship. That's what all addictions do. They take me away from connecting with others. But of course, I'm not doing it because I'm stupid. I'm doing it because I'm terrified of the intimacy that you bring to me. But I still must say no to those things. And it's hard to do. Like, it is, like, people do not maintain their addictions because they're stupid. Because they're pansies. Because they're weak. Let us throw off the sin and let us run the race with perseverance set before us. Now, interestingly enough, so I have two adult kids. a daughter who's 32, who is a solo pastor of a Presbyterian church in Nashville, and she's married to our son-in-law, who we just adore, and I have a son who's 29, who's in graduate school. He lives in Arlington at a bro house. I don't know how those things work. I don't really want to go in and find out. You know, he and six other guys. My kids are, they've had wonderful lives. And I love them dearly. But I would have to admit, that even though they are adults and functioning well, I still want to be in charge of their lives. I still don't think I get enough respect for the ideas that I have for them. Like, you know, you think that you're going to raise kids until they're like 18 and then you're like, we're done. Great. Like, no, it never stops. Like, I'll be 80 and still wanting to tell my kids how to live their lives. This is the thing. We're running the race with perseverance set before us. Somebody else is setting your race. We live in a world in which I am master of the universe. I get to decide. But then as it turns out, you know, like I work in a private practice where I see patients and I get to the office and I feel like, oh my gosh, like I'm in my zone. I'm doing and I'm like, I'm master of the universe. And then I go home and I walk in the front door where I discover that I am not master of the universe, but I still am behaving as if I think I am. This like disabuses me of this notion. We did not ask or decide or determine that we were to come into the world. The race is set for us by someone else. We live in a world in which I would like to believe that I am in charge of everything. And as it turns out, there is no such thing as self-identification. Do you know that? There's no such thing. The brain doesn't exist this way. This does not mean that I have no agency in deciding what I'd wear today. Now, usually my wife is involved in that as well, I have to admit. It does not mean that I have no agency, but it means at the end of the day, even when I have identification, I'm identifying because of something that I'm reading the cues from you. I'm identifying in response to the relationships that I have. The world is always in play with me. My course is always being set by things that are outside of who I am. My brain is not in charge of my world 100%. Are you with me? And we in the West would be affronted at that because we have been trained to think that we are independent. We've been trained to think that, like, I get to decide who I am. This is what it means to be an American. This is not what it means to live in the world of Genesis 1 and 2. To live in the world of Genesis 1 and 2 means that I'm interdependent with other people who I need, who are going to help me, who I need to protect me, who are going to help me even decide who I am. This is one of the things that we talk about storytelling, right? Evil wants to use shame to help you tell a story that is not true about who you are. But the reality is that no matter what story we tell, we are always dependent upon somebody else to help us tell it. This is what my cloud of witnesses are doing. Who is helping us tell me my story more truly? Because there will always be co-authors involved. Always. Who are they? In order for me to throw off the sin, I'm going to need help to do this. You go to in any AA recovery room, right? Like, you've got a room full of people who know that they need each other if they're going to continue to throw off the sin that so easily entangles them. If they're going to persevere over a long road that's set for them by somebody else, they're going to need connection and community. And that road that they're going to persevere on, because it's going to take a long, did I say, remember, this is going to take a long time. And it's okay. Jesus is not worried about how long this takes. He does not have benchmarks for you to meet. He just wants you to be loved. This perseverance, let us throw off the sin, run the race of perseverance, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. To fix our eyes on him is to fix our eyes on someone that we want to then be like. One of the first things that we see about Jesus is that at his baptism, as we said earlier, he receives the words of his father in Luke's version. You're my son, whom I love. Just so well pleased. I just, I just so love you. I'm just crazy about you. You know, we human beings, pastors in particular, like we can't give what we don't have. Now, when we read the Shema and the first great commandment and then the Decalogue, when we read all that, we think that we begin with this notion that the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, which is true. But it's important for us to recognize that when Moses gives that word to the people, it's predicated by something else. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I'm the God who loves you wildly. We are not commanded to love God ex nihilo. We're not commanded to love God on our own. We're commanded to love God in response to his being wildly crazy about us. I can't love him or love my neighbor just out of my own. I can only give them what I have. Here's the thing. We're not very good at loving our friends, let alone our enemies. Like, I'm not very good at this. But the reason that I'm not good at it is because there's something else that I'm even more not good at. I don't know how you say that. And that is, I'm even less able to allow myself to be loved. All of our violence toward ourselves, toward each other, whether it's in the privacy of my own mind or whether it's on the street of protest or whatever it is, or it's treating, like, all my violence is a response to my being unable to be receptive to someone loving me. And the reason that I can't do it is because I'm too afraid that the moment that you get close, you're going to repeat the same things that have happened to me and my traumas that I have not resolved. Who is your healing cloud of witnesses that give you no choice but to allow them to love you? We fix our eyes on that Jesus who's allowing his Father to love him, so that he can love others. And Jesus then goes on to scorn shame. We fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher. He's not going to let you go. He's not going to let you go. He is coming for you. He's looking for the places where the things are the most broken, and he's coming. Our son, who's 29, as I mentioned, has lived a radiant life. And he just works his tail off to be a guy of integrity. And a guy who's, he's a musician, and he's in this PhD program in public policy analysis, which I can barely get those words out of my mouth, so I'm not really even quite sure what it is that he's doing. And he started grad school in the fall of 2020. On the West Coast. We live in D.C. And this is a guy who's never asked his parents for a thing. Effective, confident, traveled the world, all kinds of things. He's the guy to whom people come when they have problems. And he's there for 3 weeks in grad school, and we get a phone call. We're talking to him just to check in, and we know that something's not right, and things are never not right with him. And his mother and I fly to L.A., figuring we're going to check on this for a couple of days and come home. And we stayed for 7 weeks. And his was a story of trauma that we didn't even know about. And in those 7 weeks, there would be multiple nights when his mother and I would go to bed, and we would hope to God that he would be alive in the morning. You got a psychiatrist and a social worker who can't do a damn thing to stop this tsunami. Now, I can say, thanks be to God. I've never been more terrified in my life as a parent. And I can say, thanks be to God, the people of God came for us. And they came for him. And enabled him to begin to do work that was important for him to do, not just because of the acuity of his current situation, but because of things that were true about him for the time he's been on the earth. This is the Jesus that we are paying attention to, the Jesus who's coming for us. But he comes for us in the embodied presence of others. He doesn't come for us magically. Who are the people who are coming for you? He scorns shame. He actually looks for shame. Jesus goes to look for it in order for him to say, thank you for your service. You're no longer needed. You're no longer needed. We're going to tell a different story now. We're not going to tell the story that reminds you that you weren't working hard enough to get the extra 8%. We're going to tell the story that says, oh my gosh, how hard you were working to get the 92. I can't wait to see what you do next. But even if you got a 90 the next time, like, I'm just so proud that you're working so hard. Psalm 27, the fourth verse, we read. This thing have I asked of the Lord, this one thing, this thing only, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, that I may gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and that I may inquire in his temple. I want to invite us to consider that God has not forgotten the first two pages of the Bible, but that the first two pages of the Bible continue to remind God of the same thing that he wants us to be reminded of, and that he is continually in the business of creating outposts of beauty and goodness in the places we would least expect it to be, just like Eden. And it begins in the center of our own souls. And it extends into our communities, just like it began to extend into the community of our blind friend in John 9. But it will take work, because we will push against the earth to do it. One thing have I asked. Again, we have a writer who's intent upon perseverance. He's paying attention to one thing. He's not somewhere in the past, somewhere in the future. He is in the place that he actually lives. Are you with me? Where, just so you know, physiologically, if you are maintaining your attention in the present moment, it is impossible physiologically to be anxious. Think about that. And then think about how often we are anxious, and then where are we? This one thing that I'm going to persevere in doing is to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. To dwell, right? This is not a drive-through. It's estimated now that if you're 35 years, perhaps for 35 years or of age or younger, that you will have up to 40 jobs by the time you would retire. Not a lot of dwelling. To dwell is to remain. To dwell is to be in one place. It is not to be moving from place to place to place to place. I am being trained to be distracted. I am not being trained to dwell. It means that we must dwell in the presence of each other. I'm going to dwell in the house of the Lord. At the time that this poem would have been collected, we were already at the time of the second temple. But it didn't begin there. It began in the tabernacle, this tent out in the wilderness. We move from this tabernacle to the first temple, and from the first temple to the second temple, and from the second temple to Jesus, who says in John 2, you knock this over in 3 days, we'll build it again. We've moved from a structure to a person, dwelling in the house of the Lord. And then we get to Pentecost and we discover, oh my gosh, it's the Holy Spirit. And then we discover when we get to 1 Corinthians 12, it's the body of Jesus. We are the house of the Lord. To dwell is to dwell with each other, who are differentiated and linked. This is where we dwell, with the people that we even don't like. Your parishioners. we dwell in the house of the Lord, that I may gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. To gaze is not to glance. To gaze is not to stare. To gaze is to look with loving kindness upon that which we are looking at. We have this exercise that we do with married couples. Some would say that for the psychiatrist, it's a little sadistic. I just have fun watching it happen. It's true. And especially, it's really cool when they're coming in after having a fight, like within 10 minutes of them are coming for the appointment. And they come in, we sit down, and we ask them to sit with their knees together. We sit, they're going to turn their chairs, they're going to be right next to each other. They're going to look right at each other. Like, look at you looking at your husband. Like, I see that right there. Right? He's not looking at you, is he? No, he knows where this is going. And the assignment is this. Without staring and without being unblinking, I just simply want to ask you to look with loving kindness upon your spouse for 5 minutes. They're like, shit. They're like, no, I'm not doing that. I don't deserve this. You should have heard what he was saying to me in the car. You can do it or not, but you're still going to pay me at the end of the hour. So thanks. So you decide you want to get something out of this or not. What do you want to do? And it will take them probably about somewhere between 60 and 120 seconds to get comfortable, to even look at each other. Because think of this. When's the last time anyone said to you, can I just look at you with loving kindness for the next 5 minutes? You're like, no, it's fine. Really. We're good. You can just tell me that you love me, and I'm just going to go for a drive. But imagine, what it would be like for you to have an experience that is much like what happens to these couples. Because at around the 2 minute mark, they find their comfort level. And at about the 3 minute mark, they're really comfortable. And for the next 2 minutes, they are just effortlessly allowing themselves to be seen by someone else with loving kindness. And when the time is up, I will tell you, to a couple, they don't want to stop. Because neither of them have looked like that at each other in forever. But this very act is something that reminds us that the body is telling us things that my words often don't. To gaze is to be present with someone, and not just the parts of someone that are easy to look at. It's not hard for us to gaze at beauty that is self-explanatory. A beautiful sunset. Heck, we were driving past the Portland, skyline. We were all driving from the hotel yesterday. And it's been like 15 years since I've been here in Portland. Like, it was just gorgeous. Just looking at that skyline, driving up along the river. It was just beautiful. Like, that's just human architecture. Like, I could stand and look at that skyline. If you live in Portland, you might say like, yeah, the skyline, whatever. But like, no, I haven't been like, because beauty is easily captures our attention because it captures us with wonder and welcome and worship. Those three things that we like to talk about that beauty typically is. But we don't typically imagine beauty to be the very thing that shows up in the places of carnage. May of 1992, veteran Smailovec became the cellist of Sarajevo when, after a mortar round killed 21 people in a breadline, he took his cello into the bomb crater, and for 21 straight days, he played. NATO couldn't get the shelling to stop. The combatants couldn't get the shelling to stop. And beauty stopped the violence in the middle of the carnage. We need to know who's coming to the places where my bomb craters are to see the beauty emerging. Remember the first page of the Bible when God saw that it was beautiful? The beauty isn't just a thing that he sees in the abstract. The beauty is a thing that emerges as a function of him looking at it. Our beauty emerges not just because we are beautiful. Our beauty emerges as a function of someone seeing us in the moment that we feel least beautiful of all. This is why we say that were it not for Easter, Good Friday wouldn't even be remembered as any day of the week. But because of Easter, we look at Good Friday and say there is nothing more beautiful than a crucified Lord. Because we know what's coming. And someone needs to be in the business of looking at your carnage knowing that they see what's coming. That I may gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. Because remember, like to gaze upon each other is to gaze upon the body of Jesus. If I'm gazing on each other, I'm gazing upon the beauty of the Lord as he does the work between us, with us, through us, in the places where we are most broken. And so they might inquire in his temple. When we are with each other in the body long enough to be willing to reveal the parts of us that we hate the most, we also then allow each other to become increasingly intimate with us and ask us questions. We ask these four questions. These are not the most important. They're not the only questions. But the first, but they all come from the words of Scripture. The first is, where are you? This is Genesis 3:9. Where are you in any given part of your life? Where are you? I want to know. In the same way that God wanted to know where Adam was, not because he was coming to kill him, but because he really wanted to be in relationship with him. Adam's shame made it difficult for Adam to imagine that God was coming to do anything but to kill him. This is what shame does. I imagine that you're coming to kill me. What do you want? John 1:38, Jesus' first words in that gospel. What do you want? It may be the most difficult question that we ever ask or answer. Most of the time, I don't know the answer because I don't want to tell you the answer because I'm afraid it'll be wrong, right? Yeah, you don't want to piss God off. I learned that this is actually the first commandment. Don't piss God off. Then love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and so forth and so on, right? That's actually, it's a little known, like, I studied some Hebrew once. I heard that there's actually a little of this insertion. What do you want? It's crucially important. Can you drink the cup? It's Matthew 20. When James and John ask Jesus for the seats to his right and to his left, actually when their mother does, faithful Jewish mother that she was, you figure, my boys have been with you for 3 years, they're not getting much in their IRAs these days, I think a seat at the right and the left would be helpful for their retirement plan. And he says, can you drink the cup that I'm about to drink? Here's the thing. If we're going to do this work, we're going to suffer. And we're going to suffer because it is painful for us to take off the stuff that is so holding us back. It is painful to give up our addictions. It is painful to look at our traumas. It is painful to do a lot of the work that it means for us to do to become outposts of beauty and goodness in the world. It's painful. But here's the thing. Even in my pain, doing it in the context of the body of Jesus transforms the very act of the pain I'm experiencing itself. Even the pain of the story is transformed because in the middle of what is so painful, if you're coming to find me, everything changes. And last, do you love me? John 21. This is Jesus' discourse with Peter. Because what Jesus is saying to Peter is not just, do you love me? Because, like, of course, we know that you do and we know that you don't. Because if you did fully, you wouldn't have thrown me under the bus 6 weeks ago. But by the way, everybody else, y'all left too, right? Like, I'm just talking to Peter because, like, you'd rather me talk to Peter rather than to talk to you, Matthew, wouldn't you? Like, you know how it is. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad he's talking to Pete. just kind of getting a little farther away from the fire, enjoy my fish over here. Oh, it's so easy for us to blame Peter for these things. Because it's too hard for me to look at the shame that I carry myself. But Jesus is really wanting to say to Peter, I'm not willing for any stone to be left unturned where any of your shame still remains. I'm coming for it. And that's what love does. Love comes for the shame of the other in order for the other to be liberated from it, in order for all of us to no longer have to burn the energy to contain my shame, so that that energy is now available for me to create the beauty and goodness in the world that has been waiting for me before its foundation. But we can't give what we don't have. In our practice, and what we've been trying to do, actually through a small nonprofit that we have called the Center for Being Known, we're actually trying to develop and create and curate what we call confessional communities. I talk about these in the Soul of Desire a fair bit. And these confessional communities, I would say, are groups of 6 to 8 people, and we're led by 2 therapists, but we're also working to find ways to export this, and how do we train people to do this without having therapists in the room, and so forth. And we have some liturgies, some what we say like the storytelling liturgies that we provide for people, and then we have, even when these groups are coming to an end, we talk about farewell liturgies as well, like how do we say goodbye properly to people because we know that 2 things. We know that we are people of great longing and we are people of great grief. And those 2 things will be real for each of us until we're dead. It's important for us to regularly be naming what our longings are, answering Jesus' question in 138 John, what do you want? In order for me to name where my griefs are, about the things, about my longings that haven't been realized, but also the places where I have relationships that are unresolved in their wounding. But we like to say that, of course, when it comes to shame, evil is going to plan on reusing it over and over and over again. He's going to remind you of the part of your story that you thought was healed, but then you have another yet interaction with your parents and remind you how much you want to kill them. Okay, we can just say that. Sometimes you just have, right, because one of the signs of mature adulthood is that we've chosen to forgive our parents. And if I'm going to forgive my parent, I actually have to identify what it is that my parent has or has not done for which they need forgiveness. Like, this is just true. To live honorably before your parents, this is, right, if I'm going to actually live out the 5th commandment, I have to know how to forgive my parents. Because we say, right, if you're a parent, the only way you don't screw up your kid is don't have them. Which means there will be things for which they will need to forgive you. And can we receive it? This kind of forgiveness is what happens in these confessional communities. Not forgiving just our parents, but forgiving each other in the community. Because sooner or later in the community, as we start to tell each other our stories and become increasingly comfortable with one another, we're going to discover that even though I think at first that the work in this community is to do my life, figure out my life that exists outside the community, at some point I become comfortable enough with you that I start to reveal things to you in ways that might piss you off, or vice versa. And pretty soon I begin to recognize that the work I am doing is not outside my community, it's right here in this room. We do this with church all the time. We come to church hoping that church will kind of like some abracadabra in that thing we call a sermon and worship. It's going to do the thing for me that I need it to do so I can go out and live my real life that's outside church. I want to tell you, church is your real life. And you will have people sitting next to you in the pew that you will conveniently not have the conversation with, but that you don't like. But what happens if you decide that that's the person that we're going to do work with? It's with that person that we're going to create beauty and goodness in the world. This is what 1 Corinthians 12 is going to look like. When we no longer allow shame to be in charge of the conversation, that we no longer allow our traumas to be the thing that is in charge of the conversation. We talk about shame as being a locomotive. Locomotive. If you were standing on a sidewalk, I'm going to wrap here in just a second. If you were standing on a sidewalk and you were to look up, this would be strange, I understand. If you were to look up and see yourself being approached by a small radio flyer wagon. You know those things, little red wagon? At 3 miles an hour. It's coming at you at 3 miles an hour. It would be odd, but if you were to see it at walking pace, that's 3 miles an hour, you would simply put your foot out and you would stop it. If you were standing on a railroad track to look up and find yourself being approached by a locomotive at 3 miles an hour, there's nothing you could do. It's not the velocity. It's the mass. And your shame is like a locomotive. There is so much real estate in your neural networks that is taken up by this phenomenon. What do we need? We need a bigger train. And a bigger train is the building of a community that reminds you that you, in fact, are the artifact of beauty that God is creating. We're not just called to make beauty in the world. God is not just wanting us to be used by him to do his work. We are his work. His artistry on the first page of the Bible is not just about the world out there. It is about us. It is important for us to have community that enables us to imagine the things post-trauma that we can't imagine unless I have someone else who helps me imagine first. We tell people, look, our job is to imagine things for you, about you, until your imagination can catch up. This is exactly what the gospel is about. Jesus is coming and saying, the Trinity, we are imagining things about y'all. And we're waiting for your imagination to catch up. And we don't care how long it takes. We're in forever. And I hope that those are words of hope. That even in the face of our trauma, even in the face of our shame, that we leave this space more able to begin to practice for the heaven that is coming. To practice imagining that we are Jesus' delight, even with the parts of us that we hate the most. And that we can't imagine that unless I have someone else saying those words to me in bone and blood on a regular basis. All for the goodness of the kingdom of God. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thanks so much for listening to part two of The Soul of the Pastor with Dr. Kurt Thompson. Video and show notes are available at togetherpdx.org/podcast. And don't forget, we have these gospel gatherings live throughout the Portland metro area about once a quarter. Go to togetherpdx.org/events to find out the next one.